The Secret Adversary. To Lloyds Bank Torquay, 16th of March 1926. To pay Wentworth Club, £8.08, every year. Mrs. A. Christie, Stiles, Sunningdale, Berkshire. Banker's Order Form, signed and kept by Agatha Christie. What did Roddy know of Mary Gerard? Nothing. Less than nothing. It was the old story, nature's hoary old joke. From Sad Cypress by Agatha Christie. In 1943, Agatha wrote her third Mary Westmacott novel, Absent in the Spring. She wrote it very quickly, in less than a week, as the idea had been burning in her for a long time. The central character, Joan Scudamore, whose life has been lived in pleasantly sheltered environs, is travelling home to England from a visit to her daughter in Baghdad. When her train fails to arrive due to bad weather, she is left alone in the desert for 3 days. During her time in the wilderness, she comes to realise that her marriage, which she had believed to be entirely happy, is a lie. Her husband, apparently so devoted and respectable, has for years been in love with another woman. Alone in the desert, Joan understands all this. She reads the signs that should have been clear. She sees what she had been too obtuse, too complacent, and too innocent to see before. Tony's scornful, boyish voice. Don't you know anything about father? She hadn't. She hadn't known a thing. Because quite determinedly, she hadn't wanted to know. When Agatha and Archie returned from the Empire tour, having finally docked at Southampton on 1st of December 1922, life was harder for them than either had anticipated. They had known that they would return to problems, but had been too excited by the idea of change, or risk, to take the realities seriously. Now they were back in a wintry London, tired and broke. Rosalind would hardly acknowledge their presence. "I want my Auntie Punky." Jessie Swannell had fallen out with Clara and been replaced with an annoying new nanny, known as Cuckoo. "Now then, little dear." Monty's erratic behaviour had driven Clara to breaking point, and Archie, whose job in the city had of course been given to somebody else, now found it impossible to get work. He probably wished he had never embarked on the tour. Agatha, who had enjoyed it immensely on the whole and retained her eager zest for life, now stayed with him in London as he trailed through the days in pursuit of employment, even though he urged her to go away with Rosalind while he was in such a depressive state. "I'm no good in trouble. I can't stand trouble." She refused to stay with Clara or Madge, remembering that a man should not be left alone, even if he wanted to be. It did not occur to her that she should put her shorthand and bookkeeping to use by getting a job. Married women of her class did not do that. But as the Christies no longer had a maid, she had work to do around the house. "I want to share this with you," she said to Archie, although she was sorely tried by his irritability and melancholia, which her presence seemed to exacerbate. Later she wrote a version of this time in her Westmacott novel, The Burden, in which the glamorous young Henry is stricken with illness and takes out his frustrations on his wife Shirley, who similarly sticks it out by his side. "I don't want to leave you." "I don't care whether you go or not. What use are you to me?" "I don't seem to be of any use," said Shirley dully. Life was catching up with Archie, in fact. The trip abroad and the toll it had taken upon his health, the humiliating search for work, the knowledge that his mother-in-law would consider him to have failed her daughter, the constant background babbling of Cuckoo, the penetrating eye of Rosalind, the anxious smiling face of his wife and, beneath it all, the memories of death and blood and terror. His nerves felt as exposed as wounds. The Christies were not mentally robust. Peg was volatile in the extreme, and in 1963 her younger son Campbell would be found dead in his gas-filled kitchen. Archie's air of masculine decisiveness, his charm and his extreme self-control kept his vulnerability hidden. But the effort cost him. He was later described as looking tied up inside. Agatha knew her husband's fragility. She had found it powerfully attractive. But now she longed above all for it not to be exposed. She dreaded Archie's unhappiness because he coped with it so badly, almost in the manner of a small boy who demanded that things be made better. "I can't stand not having what I want." She prayed that he would quickly find a job. Eventually, an offer of work was made, albeit from a firm of dubious reputation. It was employment and brought some money in, and Archie's mood improved. No more evenings spent across the table from a tense white face staring down into uneaten dinner, without television or even radio to divert the attention. On the hearth, dead embers lie, where once they burned a fire of living flame. It had been hellish, Agatha could not help but admit to herself. But now, life was back to the happy normality she craved, and her work, which thrived on that normality, was going wonderfully well. She was free of the Bodley Head, having moved to another publishing house, Collins, on greatly improved terms. She had been vexed with John Lane for some time, believing that he had taken advantage of her inexperience when he tied her into a 5-book deal. She had brooded on this during the round-the-world trip, encouraged to do so by the news that Madge's play was being considered for production. "It seems as though there was such a thing as an agent who is some good," she wrote snappishly to Clara. On her return, she hastened to Hughes Massey, the literary agency to whom Eden Philpotts had recommended her back in 1909, and this time was welcomed with open arms by the agency's new head, a young man named Edmund Cork. He could not have known quite how lucky a day it was for him when Agatha Christie walked through his door in Fleet Street, but he certainly treated her with serious respect. His manner, which was gentlemanly but direct, made him a person that Agatha could do business with. He would handle her affairs until the end of her life. For all her dreaminess, Agatha was tough when it came to selling her work. Cork encouraged this and helped her write the terse, cool letters that would extricate her from the Bodley Head contract. But the toughness was there anyway. She was, after all, the descendant of her businessman grandfather, Nathaniel, and of his wife, Margaret, who always emphasized the importance of money in a woman's life. Keep £50 in 5-pound notes somewhere safe. You never know when you might need it. In 1924, Agatha was offered £500 by the Evening News for serialization of The Man in the Brown Suit, a sum that greatly astounded her husband and sister, although not, of course, her mother. From around that time, she realized that her writing had a measurable worth and put a price on herself. Only very rarely could she be prevailed upon to do something for love rather than money. This was not a particularly English literary attitude. It surprised people, not least the BBC, which was stunned by Agatha's refusal to accept that it had the right to pay less than anybody else. Her entire approach was commercial, bitched an internal memo in 1948. The BBC was not really Agatha's kind of setup. She never liked anything state-controlled, and she certainly disliked low wages. She occasionally worked for BBC Radio, but in 1932, in a letter to the producer, she refused to write a series of short stories. "They really are not profitable. I don't mind an odd one now and again, but the energy to devise a series is much better employed in writing a couple of books. So there it is." This would always be her attitude. She worked extremely hard, and in return, she expected her fair reward. She had seen her father lose the Miller fortune through sheer blithe ignorance, and however much she had admired Frederick, she could not share his aristocratic airiness about money. She always understood that money had a value beyond that of simple currency, and she was, instinctively, a capitalist. She approved of the banker, Alistair Blunt, in "Want to Buckle My Shoe," for his belief that a country should be governed by the same economic principles that apply to a properly run household. This was Agatha's kind of thinking, Those who despised it as petty bourgeois were indulging in mere adolescent fantasy.
"Yes, but how can you be satisfied with things as they are?"
Alistair Blunt's niece says to him.
"All the waste and the inequality and the unfairness. Something must be done about it."
To which Blunt replies, in the voice of his creator, "We get along pretty well in this country, Jane, all things considered." Jane Oliveira is rich, not least thanks to Alistair Blunt, as is the upper-class David Anquetel in The Hollow, who has the similar luxury of despising his relations for their lack of political principle. "I must have a talk with you, David, and learn all the new ideas," says his cousin Lucy. "As far as I can see, one must hate everybody, but at the same time give them free medical attention and a lot of extra education. Poor things, all those helpless little children herded into schoolhouses every day." David's socialist ideals are laid bare by Midge Hardcastle, who as a worker lives what David merely talks about and has a justifiable, far more ambivalent, resentment to her idle relations with their protective layers of money. Money is central to Agatha's writings. It can override any other consideration in the minds of her characters. As both Poirot and Miss Marple are aware, it constitutes the prime motive for crime. Of her 55 full-length detective novels, murder for financial gain is at the centre of 36. But it is not just killers who like money. Nice girls like Tuppence or Jane Cleveland in Jane in Search of a Job. Clever women like Lucy Aylesbarrow in 450 from Paddington. Sweet old ladies like Dora Banner in A Murder is Announced. They are obsessed with it. The lack of it dominates lives. For all our own supposed obsession with the privileged classes, Agatha had plenty of sympathy for the desperate. "I've heard people say so often, I'd rather have flowers on the table than a meal without them." "But how many meals have those people ever missed?" says Dora Banner. "They don't know what it is. Nobody knows who hasn't been through it, to be really hungry. Bread, you know, and a jar of meat paste and a scrape of margarine. And the shabbiness." Agatha had a fear of poverty, deriving from her memory of the sudden downward swoop of the Miller fortunes. It alarmed her just to think of the way money had trickled like sand through her father's hands. In later life, she too would have money problems, which she attempted to treat with hauteur, but which in fact completely terrified her. The difference was that these came about through no fault of her own. Although she loved to spend, she always treated money with absolute respect. And it was money that changed her attitude towards her work. She was no longer writing for the love of it. She was a professional. That was how it happened. She signed a 3-book contract with Collins at the beginning of 1924, which gave her an advance of £200 per book and an improved royalty rate, negotiated by Edmund Cork, although she still had to deliver one more book to the Bodley Head, The Secret of Chimneys, published in 1925. John Lane had told Cork that Collins were welcome to Agatha if they were willing to pay that kind of money. The Bodley Head had wanted to keep hold of her and had offered another contract, but Agatha felt no obligation to them for giving her a first break. She had something of the smiling grandeur of her sister Madge, who breezed through rehearsals of her West End play, The Claimant, with the air of a duchess. "You're quite empathetic, Mrs. Watts." These two were ladies, after all, with a core of impregnable assurance. From early on, Agatha was confident in the sphere of her work. She treated Bodley Head with disdain. She bullied Edmund Cork, albeit politely, and she always stood her ground on issues like blurbs and book jackets. In 1922, she had had an altercation with her publishers over the cover of Murder on the Links, which showed the victim having apparently an epileptic fit, and, as he had never had an epileptic fit in his life, it seemed to me rather... Well, they made rather a fuss about that. In 1924, she used her own money to publish her poems, The Road of Dreams, under the imprint of Geoffrey Bless. The sales were negligible, and the works had clearly been written for the poet's own pleasure, but Agatha liked the idea of them being in print.
She was enjoying her success, which was as new and miraculous as a sudden spring sun. Through 1924 to 1926, she wrote stories not just for The Sketch, but for other magazines, including The Grand, The Novel, Flynn's Weekly, and The Royal. They would be published later in collections like Poirot Investigates, The Mysterious Mr. Quinn, and The Listerdale Mystery. Even her first story, The House of Beauty, which she had written as a teenager convalescing in bed, was published in 1926. It seemed that every piece of prose she wrote, or had ever written, was wanted. With the money from the serialization of The Man in the Brown Suit, she bought a grey Morris Cowley car. Her pleasure in it is impossible to comprehend in these days of instant travel. She could scarcely believe the rapture of being able to go to places beyond where her feet or a bus route would take her. Many years later, in her autobiography, she was still possessed by the sense of amazement that this first car had brought. She compared the excitement with that of dining at Buckingham Palace with the Queen. The Morris was hers. Did Archie resent this? Surely not, as it had been his idea to buy it and he who taught her to drive it. Why should he have cared? It has been suggested that he did care, that he was increasingly disturbed by Agatha's career, the independent income and the attention it brought her. However, his own career was now flourishing. A friend in the city, named Clive Bailio, had invited him to join his firm, Austral Development Limited. "This made Archie immediately, wonderfully, completely happy," wrote Agatha. He was now properly established in the world of finance, for which he had a decided aptitude. Things were good. Money was no longer a worry. Agatha received irregular but satisfying sums. Archie was earning around $2,000 a year, and surely even Clara would be satisfied with that. Nor was it just his new job that delighted Archie. He had fallen in love with golf. Agatha had introduced him to it after the war, during their weekends spent in East Croydon, and from the early 1920s onwards, it became for him a way of life. He played every weekend he possibly could, on any nearby course, and then, as his game improved, at Sunningdale. "I was," wrote Agatha Riley in her autobiography, "becoming that well-known figure, a golf widow." In Unfinished Portrait, she is unable to hide her sense of loss, saying, "We've always spent the weekends together, you and I." He is patiently reassuring in reply. "It isn't that I don't love you. I love you just as much as ever. But a man likes doing things with other men, and he needs exercise. If I was wanting to go off with other women, well then, you might have something to complain about. But I never want to be bothered with any other women but you. I hate women. I just want to play a decent game of golf with another man. I do think you're being rather unreasonable about it." Yes, probably she was being unreasonable. And so it was that Agatha agreed to live at Sunningdale. She had wanted to leave London for some time, but Archie would only countenance a place near a good golf course. Like Anne Bedingfield in The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha gave in for the sake of her own happiness. There is really nothing a woman enjoys so much as doing all the things she doesn't like for the sake of someone she does like. Of course, the dark-leafed Surrey-Berkshire border was not her idea of the country. Having been brought up in Devon, having known pink and gold hills and the gleam of the sea every morning, Sunningdale looked to her cramped and meretricious. But Archie's upbringing had been very different. He had never lived with space and relaxed grandeur, and he liked the comfortable feel of the home counties. He could get along with the people. City types such as himself was now becoming, although Agatha found them alien, cautiously social, in a way that she had never before encountered. So unlike the families she had known in Torquay, ranging happily around their large villas with the peeling paint and the good old furniture. The Christies found a flat in a house called Scotswood, which seemed to Agatha typical of Sunningdale, a vast jumble of gables, half timbering and mock Tudor. It stood at the end of a short drive, behind trees, off one of the well-tended avenues. At night, the lights in all the differently shaped windows gave it a disoriented look. But it cost little more than Addison's mansions, which decided the question, and Agatha set to decorating it. With her usual creative delight in homemaking, she hung curtains, patterned with different flowers. Tulips for the dining room, buttercups and daisies for Rosalind's room, bluebells for the main bedroom, which was not really a good choice. They looked grey and dispirited, as the room received almost no sun. Like a little girl, she cheered herself up by writing a poem about Bluebell, wild Bluebell, who dances in the wood. She was happy, having made Archie happy. Her newly contented husband was the person she wanted to be with. We had been through so much worry since we came back from our world tour that it seemed wonderful to enter on this halcyon period. Everything seemed set fair. She had her dog, her daughter, her writing, her man. She even had Clara, now aged 70, dividing her time between Ashfield and her daughters, staying in the other top-floor flat at Scotswood. Wandering out into the garden in the early morning with Aubrey at her heels, Celia felt that life had become almost perfect. No more dirt and dust and fog. This was home. The first book that Agatha wrote for Collins was the one that changed her reputation forever. No doubt she knew, as through 1925, she turned the idea over in her mind that here she had a winner. The Murder of Roger Ackroyd is the supreme, the ultimate detective novel. It rests upon the most elegant of all twists, the narrator, who is revealed to be the murderer. This twist is not merely a function of plot. It puts the whole concept of detective fiction on an armature and sculpts it into a dazzling new shape. It was not an entirely new idea. Agatha had played with it before, when she had her Sir Eustace Pedler narrate part of The Man in the Brown Suit. Nor was it entirely her own idea, since it was suggested to her by both James Watts. Why not have a Watson do the murder? And in a rather self-important letter sent by Lord Louis Mountbatten, which did not merely offer the device, but explained exactly how it should be used. Agatha very rarely took advice on her plots, although a great deal was offered in the course of her career. But here, she realized, was an idea worth having. And only she could have pulled it off so completely. Only she had the requisite control, the willingness to absent herself from the authorial scene and let her plot shine clear. The artist is only the glass through which we see nature, and the cleaner and more absolutely pure that glass, so much the more perfect the picture we can see through it. So wrote Eden Philpotts to Agatha back in 1909. The manner in which she took his advice was perhaps not quite what he had intended, as he had been thinking of her as a straightforward novelist, whose model should be Flaubert. But she applied the Flaubertian principle to her detective fiction. In Roger Ackroyd, she revealed for the first time her natural quality of translucency, her ability to control every sentence of her books, yet allow them to breathe free. Agatha did not impose, nor did she interpose one atom of herself between her writing and her readers. Her words communicate exactly and only what is required, which is not the same as saying that they have no life beyond what is on the page. They have, in fact, the mystery of simplicity. They are the conduits for her plots, which are also ultimately simple. And her plots are the conduits for her ideas of character, which are complex. In fact, in Roger Ackroyd, character is not yet as important as it would become when Agatha was writing at her peak in the years between 1935 and 1950. By then, she would know fully how to integrate character with plot, how to make plot an immaculate distillation of character. Thus, a novel such as Five Little Pigs, one of her very best, is a mystery resolved into simplicity by an understanding of human complexity. A beautiful process and a beautiful book. The beauty of Roger Ackroyd is of a different kind, that of a diamond whose every facet gleams, whose geometry is perfection. Every line, every angle, leads towards resolution. The plot progresses not in linear form, as a story with a beginning, middle, and end, but by the architectural construction of a shape that eventually reveals its true dimensions. It is masterly, exquisite. And although the book is more of a mathematical exercise in ingenuity than a full-blown novel, it does hint of profundity. The character of the narrator, Dr. Shepherd, is shadowy because he is, by definition, obfuscating. Yet this reticence translates into a sense of a hollow man, a man whose extreme self-control conceals guilt, grief, emotions that he can never express. "I have lost the quality of resilience long since myself," he says. And his sister, who knows more about him than he would wish, tells Poirot that he is weak as water. "You are weak, James, with a bad bringing up. Heaven knows what mischief you might have got into by now." These are clues. They are also truths. At the end of the book, Shepherd kills himself in order to spare his sister suffering. His last words are bleak, pathetic, and somehow very real. "Not that I take any responsibility for Mrs. Ferrars' death. It was the direct consequence of her own actions. I feel no pity for her. I have no pity for myself either. So let it be, Verrinal. But I wish Hercule Poirot had never retired from work and come here to grow vegetable marrows." How did Agatha develop from the amateur, trying things as one does, into the creator of this dazzlingly accomplished book? By degrees, by intelligence, by instinct, by confidence, by courage, by trusting her own judgment about what made her writing work, by having a mind uncluttered with received ideas and an imagination that naturally ran so free she could enjoy the exercise of its restraint. It was a relief, in fact, to trammel it within a genre. Although the structural work of a detective novel was very difficult, there was joy in the discipline. She was ordering her brain like a well-run establishment. Like Lucy Aylesbarrow in 450 from Paddington, she was shining the silver and scrubbing the kitchen table and making a Spanish omelette with the leftover potatoes. She was living in a world where all could be known, all motives uncovered, all ambiguities penetrated, where mysteries are within her control. In her novel A Pocketful of Rye, Agatha described the home of her murder victim. This place, this pretentiously named Yew Tree Lodge, was just the kind of mansion that rich people built themselves when they called it their little place in the country. It wasn't in the country either, according to Inspector Neal's idea of the country. The house was a large, solid, red brick structure, with rather too many gables and a vast number of leaded paned windows. The gardens were highly artificial, all laid out in rose beds and pergolas and pools, and living up to the name of the house with the large numbers of clipped yew hedges. Thus she remembered the house in Sunningdale, Styles, as she and Archie renamed it, to which they moved from Scotswood at the start of 1926. Yew Tree Lodge is similarly set in the commuter belt. Baden Heath was almost entirely inhabited by rich city men. It had an excellent train service, was only 20 miles from London, and was comparatively easy to reach by car. It also had 3 well-known golf courses. Sunningdale had 2, having newly developed the course at Wentworth, in which Agatha bought a debenture share so that she could play there at weekends. Despite her authorial control, she cannot help giving a dark quality to A Pocketful of Rye, which derives from its setting and the smart, vulgar, very unpleasant people who live there. A ruthless city man with a sexy young wife, the wife's lounge-lizard lover, whom she meets when pretending to play golf. Agatha can scarcely hide her contempt for Baden Heath. This was how, 30 years earlier, she increasingly felt about Sunningdale. At first, there was intense pleasure in walking among trees and feeling clean air on her face, although in fact there were so many cars in Sunningdale that the air was positively choked compared to the high, fresh breezes of Torquay. Archie had suggested they buy a second car, something glamorous like a Delage, as their finances continued to improve. Agatha suggested instead that they have another baby. But to this, Archie replied that there was plenty of time, although Agatha was coming up to 35, and that anyway he did not need another child, Rosalind being perfect. They bought the Delage. Perhaps Agatha had thought that another child, a son, would arouse in her the maternal instincts that as yet remained dormant. Perhaps she thought that she would have her child, Rosalind being indubitably Archie's. Judy was so aloof, so unattached. She was like Dermot. The mere fact that Agatha could write this about her daughter shows her own detachment. She knew that Rosalind would read the book after all. She would learn that her mother had seen her as a complete puzzle, full of depressing common sense, with an almost repellent love of her father's rough games. But Unfinished Portrait was written by somebody unable to stop themselves, heedless of pain or shame or damage, and half hidden as she was behind her pseudonym, Agatha felt compelled to write the truths of that time as she saw them. The growing subterranean despair, the creeping sense of disengagement. They had a good many neighbours there, most of them with children. Everyone was friendly. The only thing that made a difficulty was Dermot's refusal to go out to dinner. "Look here, Celia, I come down from London tired out, and you want me to dress up and go out and not get home and to bed till past midnight. I simply can't do it."
"Not every night, of course. But I don't see that one night a week would matter."
"Well, I don't want to go. You go if you like."
"I can't go alone. People don't ask you to dinner except in pairs. And it sounds so odd for me to say that you never go out at night, because after all, you're quite young."
"I'm sure you could manage to go without me." But that wasn't so easy. In the country, as Celia said, people were asked in couples or not at all. So she refused the invitations, and they sat at home, Dermot reading books on financial subjects, and Celia sometimes sewing, sometimes sitting with her hands clasped. This was not the whole truth, of course. It was the underside. Agatha had a successful and fulfilled life. Her books were admired, her family was healthy and handsome, her future prospects were good. In fact, it was all most enviable. Agatha felt this herself. But beneath it lay Celia, fearful and questing and unable to make this grown-up life her own. Desperately in love with Dermot, yet only truly herself with her mother. She could say, "I am so happy," without having to catch back the words at Dermot's frown. Nobody would have believed Celia to exist within the confident, clever woman of substance, a little too much substance by then, whose stories and photograph appeared in the sketch, whose The Murder of Roger Ackroyd would soon be published to acclaim and controversy. There was a body of opinion that considered the novel a cheat, although in fact it plays entirely fair. Celia writes just one book, not a detective story, purely as an outlet for her powerful imagination. She never becomes a professional at anything. She remains a dreaming, drifting girl. She does not grow up in any way. She didn't look like a writer, this young creature with her Scandinavian fairness, thinks the man who publishes her book. She remains young, not just emotionally, but physically. Inside that was how Agatha still thought of herself, as the lovely nymph who had danced through Torquay and into the arms of her husband. She is Jane in The Secret Adversary, who has a wild rose quality about her face. She is Anne in The Man in the Brown Suit, with the beauty that drives men mad. She is Flora in The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, who, with her real Scandinavian pale gold hair, has exactly the looks of the young Agatha. But Flora Ackroyd was dreamed into life by a woman who, only in her 30s, had become middle-aged. She was not unattractive. Her smiling charm did not show itself in photographs, but she had lost her particular quality of beauty. Her masculine features needed lightness and youth to offset them. These had disappeared with the birth of Rosalind. so she created lovely girls whose looks she had once shared, and although there was pleasure in doing so, it also caused anguish. Meanwhile, Archie remained lean, intense, attractive as ever. Perhaps Agatha should have done more about this physical disparity. "I hope I am getting thinner with all this walking," she wrote to Clara from an Italian holiday in 1924. Agatha's tone on this trip was very much that of the Empire tour, enthusiastic and blithe. "We got ourselves to Milan, spent the afternoon of Wednesday there, and on to Bologna." As he had on the tour, Archie fell ill, had a temperature and went to bed whilst I jeered at him and said it was liver. They would be home soon, Agatha told her mother. Archie has an autumn meeting of golf at Sunningdale the first week in October. The golf was becoming a nightmare for her, although she pretended it was not. So trivial was it in itself, she could never quite believe the extent to which it asserted its importance. It was as if her life were dominated by train spotting or kites. But any childlike optimism that Archie's passion would blow itself out was misplaced. His obsession continued to grow. She was unable to invite friends from London to stay unless the man played golf. Otherwise, Archie resented giving up his free time. This meant that Agatha herself was often left alone, having scarcely seen her husband during the week. She had her writing to think about, of course, and did so increasingly. One of the stories published during the Sunningdale period was Philomel Cottage, which appeared in Grand magazine in November 1924. It is the story of a woman, Alex, who throws over a devoted suitor in order to marry a man of whom she knows nothing, and who, she gradually realizes, is planning to kill her. A solution of sorts came to Agatha's solitary weekends. Nan Pollock, sister to James Watts, was now on her second marriage to a man named George Conn, a golfer. Nan and Agatha had liked each other from Madge's wedding day. Now they would sit and chat while Rosalind and Judy, 3 years the elder, played together in the garden, or they themselves played a few incompetent holes on the ladies' course. Afterwards, they met their husbands at the clubhouse for drinks. Agatha chose not to take alcohol, although the official line that she was a lifelong teetotaler is not quite true. On the Empire tour, she had enjoyed the odd glass of Burgundy. But despite her weight gain, and perhaps Archie's embarrassment, she now preferred the comforting glasses of mixed cream and milk that she had drunk as a girl when staying with Nan at Abney. By this time, Agatha got on better with Nan than she did with her sister, although she was intrigued to have Madge stay for weekends at Scotswood in 1924, during the rehearsal period for The Claimant. Although by then Agatha was decidedly the more successful, her sister still fascinated and irked her. She was so wildly assured, so appallingly charming. "The head of the press bureau approached me for an interview," wrote Madge to her husband, "and I said I didn't want to be known. All I told him was that I was Agatha Christie's sister, and he simply revels in styles and has read all her books. So perhaps we'll have to be the Dolly sisters after all." This easy generosity, of which Agatha herself would not have been capable, was even more annoying, since it somehow implied that Agatha's acceptance by the press was within Madge's gift. Of course, she and Archie attended a performance of The Claimant, and it was fun, in a sense, to be writers together with Madge, particularly when it became clear that The Claimant was not quite the work of genius she had been led to believe. Madge planned to write a play about Warren Hastings, but despite the enthusiasm of her producer, Basil Dean, this did not happen. Agatha remembered it, though. In Absent in the Spring, Joan Scudamore meets an old school friend, Blanche, and asks, somewhat condescendingly, if her husband ever wrote this book on Warren Hastings. He had. It was never published. Archie was on perfectly friendly terms with Madge, although he may have had his fill of Agatha's family by the mid-1920s. Monty continued to be a nuisance. On his return from the Empire tour, Archie had found a flat for his brother-in-law and offered to install him in it. Instead, he ended up escorting him to a favoured hotel in Jermyn Street,
saying to Agatha, it seemed so reasonable the way he put it. Then Agatha had helped Madge buy the cottage for Monty on Dartmoor. James Watts was always annoyed by the way his wife threw money at this problem, but in Agatha's case, the money was her own, and there was nothing Archie could say. Meanwhile, Clara was just along the corridor, no doubt encouraging the purchase of the cottage. She was not permanently at Sunningdale, as she still had Ashfield and Abney, and to preserve her sense of independence, Agatha arranged for her to stay in rooms with some friends in London. But she was often at Scotswood, and in her frail old age, she had become, as even Agatha admitted, difficult to get on with. Not that Archie had ever found her especially easy. Although he had expected to be jealous when Agatha had a baby, this had not in fact been the case. Yet he remained jealous of Clara. Agatha's devotion to her mother, the near obsession with Ashfield, the letters she had written from abroad to her precious mummy, it was hardly usual behaviour in an adult woman. And Clara's adoration of Agatha was another irritant. Of course, Peg Hemsley thought the same way about Archie, and was similarly hard to avoid, having moved to Dorking in Surrey. The difference was that Archie took no notice of his mother, while Agatha remained under Clara's spell. Now Clara was taking a hand in the education of Rosalind. She was a natural teacher, and Rosalind responded well to her. She knows and understands her grandma, and her grandma loves and understands her Rosalind, Clara wrote from Abney in early 1926. It was not quite interference, but from Archie's point of view, Clara was always too much of a presence in his life, with her unnerving quickness and penetrating eye. I was wrong about Dermot, says the mother in Unfinished Portrait. When you married him, I didn't trust him. I didn't think he was honest or loyal. I thought there would be other women. Oh, mother, Dermot never looks at anything but a golf ball. At which Miriam smiles, then says, he's very attractive. He's attractive to women, Celia, remember that. He's a frightfully stay-at-home person, Mummy. Yes, that's lucky. It was true that, aside from his golf, Archie had no wish to be out and about. He liked a normal, controlled family life. He craved a wife who bestowed constant reassurance with a light, quiet touch. Agatha's success was not particularly intrusive, although it had gone beyond what either of the Christies had expected, and she still put Archie first, even if he did not think so. Her marriage was by far the most important thing in her life. That was why she had moved to Sunningdale, bought her debenture at the golf club, agreed to the plan of building a house on the Wentworth estate, when in her heart she yearned to leave this tight little gin-drinking society behind her and live somewhere large and free. Let me see. Shirley's eyes half closed. She spoke dreamily. I'd like to live on an island rather far away from anywhere. I'd like to live in a white house with green shutters. Archie knew her longings. He knew that there was a wildness in Agatha that did not belong in Sunningdale. He had fallen in love with her dreamy poetic aspect, although he had not fully understood it. He had seen bliss and safety in the girl with whom he had danced amid the pink stone of Ugbrook. How sweet she had been, how soothing, with her cool hand in his. How beautiful, too, his Elaine, with her slim body in its long skirts, her magical quantities of pale hair that she took down at night for his eyes alone. You are lovely and perfect in every way. But what had been adorable in a young girl was now faintly repulsive. Agatha's artistic soul had once expressed itself with discretion. Now, there was something uncontrolled about her eagerness, her zest for life, her childishness. Dermot hated you to say what you were feeling. He felt it somehow to be indecent. The Agatha of 1912 was the same woman as the Agatha of 1926. But to Archie, she seemed a different person. Louder, larger, uglier. Yes, more difficult to disguise that you were silly, as your looks left you. A sudden flash of memory. Don't ever grow less beautiful, will you, Celia?
Yes, but that was all over now. They'd lived together long enough for such things as the beauty of a face to have lost its meaning. Dermot was in her blood, and she in his. Styles was not the house that either Agatha or Archie had wanted, but they were tired of the flat at Scotswood, and felt it was time to buy. The plan to build a new home on the Wentworth estate came to nothing, although, according to Agatha's autobiography, the Christies had spent happy summer evenings tramping over Wentworth looking out for a site which we thought would suit us. The quality of the numinous, so essential to Agatha, bloomed on those walks as she dreamed a house, her house, into life. But in the end, it was deemed too expensive, £5,300, and too complicated. Easier to take on something ready-made, with a nice garden for Rosalind, conveniently near to the station for Archie. The Christies looked around for a year or so before they took out a mortgage on Styles, and had plenty of time to find something they really liked. Instead, they acquired the house described in A Pocketful of Rye, large, modern, red brick, with leaded windows like small black eyes and a thick shroud of trees. It is impossible to imagine Agatha living in this place. Compared to Ashfield, which had light and magic and homeliness, Styles was as immutable as a stockbroker's fortress. Inside, it was decorated regardless of expense, with panelling, gilt, and quantities of bathrooms, although the plan was to change all this when it could be afforded. Outside could not be changed. Styles was handsome, but it had a cold, dead look. During the war, a woman had been murdered in the copse behind it. Agatha hated the house. Rosalind liked it for its gardens. Archie was indifferent to it. "I am sorry for you settling in," Clara wrote to Agatha from Ashfield. "It is always so full of unexpected worries." Chief among these was money. The Christies had overstretched themselves and were running 2 cars and 3 servants. There was also Charlotte Fisher, employed to look after Rosalind and to act as Agatha's secretary typist. Rosalind had previously had an excellent nanny, Miss White, known as Sight, and a hopeless Swiss governess, Marcel. She now attended Oakfield School in Sunningdale, but Agatha felt the need for help with her daughter, and so it was that Charlotte, or Carlo, as she was later known, came to live with the family. She was young, highly intelligent, the daughter of an Edinburgh chaplain, and as one of her nieces later described her, a very splendid person. There was in her something of Catherine Grey in The Mystery of the Blue Train, the novel that Agatha began to write after Roger Ackroyd. Catherine has both judgment and humour, despite being obliged to earn her living as a companion. As Charlotte did Clara, she handles old ladies with patient kindness. Charlotte also commanded instant respect from Rosalind, and despite the 10-year age gap, got along very well with Agatha. She was the kind of person with whom Agatha felt comfortable. Like Catherine Grey, she said little and listened a good deal. She could size people up with her cool Scottish eye, and she thought the world of her employer.